From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the 1980s, Jay McInerney wrote about people who abused drugs and alcohol in his novel Bright Lights, Big City. Now he's writing about the subtleties of Pinot Noir and Bordeaux. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with McInerney about writing his wine column and how he's tried to write about wine without being snobbish or cliched. His columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. Also, actress Eva Marie Saint talks about starring with Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront and with Cary Grant in North by Northwest. She stars in the new TV movie, Papa's Angels, which will be broadcast Sunday night. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The first truckload of ballots has arrived at a Tallahassee courthouse. They were ordered by a circuit court judge who's deciding whether they should be recounted at the request of Vice President Al Gore. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The yellow rental truck was followed by helicopters and a media convoy as it made its way up the Ronald Reagan Turnpike from Palm Beach. It contained 462,000 ballots. The Gore campaign says those and another 600,000 expected here from Miami Friday may contain as many as 2,000 unrecorded votes for president. They want Judge Sanders Sauls to start counting the ballots immediately and went to Florida Supreme Court in hopes it will issue an order to that effect. Meanwhile, a select panel of Florida's legislature voted along party lines to recommend a special session, the purpose to name its own slate of electors. Vice presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman said the lawmakers were precipitating a constitutional crisis. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Tallahassee.
Lawyers for the two sides faced off in the Florida Supreme Court today to argue whether the counting of the ballot should begin before Judge Sauls makes his decision. Gore's legal team said it's essential to begin counting, otherwise the job won't be finished before Florida names its electors. Lawyers for George W. Bush said it's not appropriate to start counting the ballots before the judge decides whether there was a legal problem with the way the election was certified. The six-member Federal Election Commission has redefined the relationships that are allowed between candidates and outside interest groups. Critics say the new regulations open a huge loophole as interest groups continue to pump more money into the political system. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
It's against the law for an interest group to coordinate a high-priced media effort with a candidate it's trying to help. But the standard of what constitutes coordination has gotten progressively weaker. Now, the FEC has adopted a new rule. It says candidates and interest groups can talk about campaign tactics as long as they don't get too specific. Commissioner Danny McDonald, a Democrat who opposed the rule, says it will allow candidates to get help from well-heeled outsiders just by dropping a few obvious hints. He says the new test of illegal coordination is too lax.
If you cannot pass this test, you should be summarily dismissed from the political arena for malfeasance.
The FEC will likely have to defend the new rule in a court test. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 214 points, or 2%, to close at 10,417 in heavy trading. The technology-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index lost 109 points, or 4%, to close at 2598. This is NPR News. As leaders of the Florida legislature indicated that they may hold a special session to name a slate of electors, the Bush and Gore team submitted written arguments on the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court. Lawyers for Gore said the Florida legislature doesn't have the constitutional authority to name electors. They say the voters have already made that choice, even though the outcome still isn't known. Bush's legal team says the Supreme Court should decide the issue now so there won't be rival slates of electors. A new college study shows that states vary widely in the availability and quality of higher education. According to the report, the state where a student lives is the largest factor in whether or not they'll get a degree. NPR's Robert Smith reports.
The state-by-state report card was prepared by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education and was compiled using census and Department of Education data. Although race and income were major factors, the report focused on the way states finance universities and how states prepare their students for college. It found wide disparities. In California, for instance, almost 40% of young people are enrolled in college. In neighboring Nevada, participation in higher ed is half that. The cost of a degree is also unevenly distributed. In New York State, tuition takes up a third of a family's income. In Illinois, only a quarter. In every state, low-income families and minorities fared the worst in getting a higher education. The study is designed for state leaders to take stock of the relative strengths and weaknesses of their systems. The $1.5 million survey took more than 2 years to complete. Robert Smith, NPR News, Seattle.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 index lost 27 points or 2% to close at 1,315. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the holidays coming, there may be some cheap wine and hopefully fine wine in your future. Jay McInerney has written about both, from the Matus that seemed so sophisticated when he was in college to the rare wines he collects today. Yes, it's the same Jay McInerney who writes fiction and who first became known in the 80s for chronicling the New York City club scene in his novel Bright Lights, Big City. His six novels include Brightness Falls and The Last of the Savages. For the past 5 years, he's written a wine column for House and Garden magazine. Those columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me, Adventures in the Wine Cellar. McInerney wanted to find a new vocabulary to talk about wine and avoid the clichés like comparing wines to flowers and herbs.
It just seemed to me that someone with a new set of analogies and similes and metaphors might have a legitimate place in this genre. I tend to compare wines more often to poems, composers, pop songs, fashion models, actors and cars than I do to things that grow in the garden.
If, for example, you describe white Burgundies as very Catherine Deneuve, more Jules and Jim than Die Hard.
Well, this would be a particular white Burgundy, because of course other white Burgundies would be more Kate Moss, for instance, Chablis.
Right.
You know, I admire people who have there are wine critics who have these incredible olfactory instruments, you know, who can detect aromas of honeysuckle and cocoa and almost any of us can get this sort of cigar smoke stuff, but I don't feel that, I don't feel that's my strength. And I also feel that there is something very subjective about the appreciation of wine, and the role of a wine enthusiast, which I take myself to be, is to just get people interested in trusting their own subjective impressions.
Well, wine writing and wine collecting is often seen as kind of snobbish, something only for people who have lots of money and lots of time on their hands.
Yeah, it is, and that's something certainly that I've tried to address and dispel a little bit in my column. I mean, I think that humor is the best weapon against this particular aspect of the wine world. As far as snobbery and expense go, I think actually we're at an interesting time in the history of wine in which it's quite possible to drink very well on a very modest budget. Technological advances have made good table wine a lot better than it was 20 years ago, and there's an awful lot of stuff you can get out there for $7, $8, $10, for instance.
What are the technological advances, and how have they changed the taste of accessible wines?
Well, until fairly recently, until the advent of stainless steel tanks and refrigeration technology, before this was widespread throughout Europe, white wines tended to be very frequently spoiled and very frequently short-lived, even if they weren't spoiled. cheap white wine was a very dangerous and ugly proposition until very recently. Something that was likely to be acidic and nasty, as likely to be acidic and nasty as to be fresh and fruity and all the things that we want in a white wine. Technology isn't always a bad thing, although for a long time in California, they carried technology, I think, too far. They, naturally, being Americans, we tend to believe in technology. And in the early days of California winemaking, chemicals and refrigeration and filtration were relied upon to the point that they often stripped the character out of what really is a sort of a living organic substance. I think now there's a nice balance in our understanding of what technology can and can't do. The best stuff takes place in the vineyard. The French believe that the wine is made in the vineyard. The Californians, until recently at least, tended to believe it was made in the cellar.
You write that when you started out writing about wine, you were pretty uninformed and uninterested in California wines, but you've since changed your mind about that. What got you to change your mind?
Well, about the same time that I started writing, I think there were a lot of California winemakers who were turning to a more natural approach, who were starting to make sort of interesting, quirky, artisanal wines, you know, wines that didn't taste like they had come out of a laboratory. That was also partly a question of education, visiting California and tasting some of these wines. I grew up on the East Coast and spent most of my life in the East Coast or in Europe. And for a long time, it seemed that the value from France and Italy was a little better. The French had a string of great vintages in the 80s, and I found myself too busy collecting and drinking these to really discover California until recently.
When your editor told you that your first column should be about Chardonnay, you say you wanted to murder the editor. Why?
Well, at the time, I just felt that California Chardonnay was a bore. Essentially the Pamela Anderson of the wine world, you know. I mean, I have nothing against, artificial blondes with large synthetic breasts, but, it's not really my type. And that was pretty much the way I felt about California wines. I felt that they were unsubtle, that they were overblown, that they tended to derive a lot of their flavors from the oak barrels that that they were aged in. And I think that I was right to some extent. However, I was sent on assignment to California, and I discovered that there are exceptions, increasingly so, and that there were some great winemakers who were challenging that kind of monolithic palate. But the average California Chardonnay was I thought a terrible beast, and so this was my feeling as I ventured forth in my first column.
But at the same time, you write that Chardonnay in almost any price range is the most idiot-proof wine in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Not necessarily subtle, but you say like Harrison Ford, it gets the job done.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Harrison Ford, the action hero of the white wine world. I think there are more. I think that there are certainly more subtle wines. There's subtle grapes than Chardonnay. On the other hand, Chardonnay is very versatile. It can be grown in a wide variety of climates, and it tends to sort of transmit messages from the soil, the winemaker. There's a huge spectrum of flavors associated with Chardonnay. But in general, I think partly just because we're all used to it, it's a safe bet at a dinner party. You know, you're taking a chance when you serve Riesling or Viognier to a new group.
Let's go to the other extreme for a moment. What's one of the most kind of rare and special wines that you've had that was a real memorable experience for you?
Well, my favorite white wine, I wouldn't drink it every day because it is a little exotic, is called Condrieu. It's made from the Viognier grape. They do grow it in California, but I wouldn't really recommend the Californian product yet. They're still trying to figure out what to do with it. It's a very temperamental grape, but it's a beautiful, beautiful white wine when it's vinified correctly. The best example comes from this region called Condria on the Rhone Valley. Whenever I have served it or ordered it at a restaurant, people have inevitably called me at some point to say, "What was that wine that you ordered?" And they're thinking about a date or something like that. It has a very haunting fragrance, which is very floral. A friend of mine who's far richer and better traveled than I am told me that it smells like the garden in the Hotel du Cap on the French Riviera, and I'm willing to take his word for it. It's actually become a bit of a cult wine in recent years.
But you yourself would be more likely to compare a wine to a movie or a poem or a song. So
yeah, to me,
rather than
to
a
me,
garden, is anything to me, come to mind? Yeah.
Well, to me, what Condria reminds me of is is Coleridge's poem, Xanadu. or to Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan. And Kubla Khan's Pleasure Dome, the great unfinished poem that he wrote supposedly when he was whacked out of his mind on opium. It also reminds me a little bit, I'd say, if Condria were a painting, it would probably be something by Fragonard or possibly by Gauguin in his Tahitian period, if that helps you at all.
What kind of response do you get to these analogies in your columns?
They're meant to be suggestive and not definitive, but...
he said this was like Gauguin, and it isn't. I tasted that wine. It's not like Kubla Khan.
It's definitely Van Gogh. I think they're helpful, but as I say, as I said earlier, the responses that good wine evokes are subjective, and they're often ephemeral. A great bottle of wine can taste different on different occasions, depending on the context, depending on one's mood, depending on one's palate, depending on the temperature. I think, you know, even the great Robert Parker, who tends to rate wines on the good old numerical scale, on the 100-point scale, would agree that wine is not a fixed, objective, fully quantifiable substance. So these are starting points, I think, for the appreciation of wines. But when we meet a great wine, when we taste a great wine, we want to say something more than "it's good," and this is the quest, really, of the wine critic, to say something that seems to give resonance to the experience.
My guest is novelist Jay McInerney. His wine columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Jay McInerney. He writes a wine column for House and Garden magazine. Those columns are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. I guess a lot of people want guidelines on how to look for wine or what to do, what not to do. And you've done your job in presenting 10 rules. let's just talk about a couple of them. Avoid artichokes. What's wrong with artichokes and wine?
Artichokes just pretty much kill any appreciation of any ability to appreciate fine wine. They asparagus is also pretty tough. It's just chemical elements in these foods that tend to turn almost any wine bitter on the palate.
So you should drink beer instead if you're having artichokes? Or Coke?
You should probably just sip your water and wait for the... have a piece of bread after you finish your artichoke. I've heard of sommeliers who actually take on the challenge of trying to match a white wine with an artichoke, but I've never found a successful combination. I ran into some guy in France last year who won the World Sommelier Competition, who claimed that he found some Swiss wine that went really well with artichokes, but I don't believe it.
You say there's no such thing as a bad champagne.
Well, that's hyperbole, perhaps, but it's true that there are very few bad champagnes imported to the United States. Generally speaking, the quality level in champagne is as high as anywhere in the world. All of the major champagne houses make a great product, whether it's Moët or Veuve Clicquot. Mumm's has gotten much better in recent years. I love French champagne, and it is pretty hard to get a bad one unless it's badly stored. You want to buy your champagne someplace that has a high turnover, because it will get a little funky if it's kept in a warm place for too long.
You say beware of famous European vintages in their youth.
Their youth. Yeah. One of the things that allegedly makes a great vintage is the ability to age. A lot of these wines are very tough to drink when they're young. Oh, just to take a recent example, the 1995 Bordeaux is by most measures a great vintage. However, it's very, very tough on the palate right now. It's very high in tannin, which is a preservative agent. It tastes like you'll know the taste of tannin if you think of a tea bag that sat in your tea for too long. That is what makes wine long-lived, but it also makes for a nasty experience early on. And the 1997 Bordeaux vintage, for instance, which is not judged to be very good because it won't be long-lived, is a much more pleasant beverage right now. The problem, of course, is that a lot of these wines will be consumed by people who have looked at vintage charts and heard that 1995 is better than 1997. So sometimes the off-vintage can be a better bet on your restaurant wine list.
How has writing about wine affected what you eat and what else you drink? And your whole approach to eating.
It has made me more food conscious and more more interested in food, because to me the two experiences are inextricable. In France and in Italy, they tend to think of wine as food. I remember I was over for a tour promoting my latest novel a couple of years ago in Italy, and I was always being urged to have a glass of wine with lunch, and I said, I don't drink at lunch. And they looked at me and they said, it's not drinking, it's wine. Wine, looked at in one way, wine is food. And I think that the appreciation of wine is greatly enhanced by the right kinds of food. It's one of the adventures of wine appreciation is matching wines with food.
So, like, say you're having a fine wine. I mean, I suppose you're not going to have pizza with it or a hamburger. You should be having something that's as subtle as the wine itself.
You can. A hamburger would be fine, but I would say lay off the ketchup.
Uh-huh.
You could have a hamburger with a great California Cabernet. And if you are going to have wine with pizza, it should be Barbera, which is an Italian wine, which has very high acidity, which cuts through that acidity of the tomato sauce. There's a lot of simple wines that go very well with simple foods.
Name some more good simple wines.
Well, let's see. Again, another tomato sauce friendly Italian wine would be Dolcetto. Beaujolais is a real all-purpose kind of a wine. We're now in the Beaujolais Nouveau season. I personally don't like the Beaujolais Nouveau. I find it too fruity and flamboyant, but to go with it, much of anything. But Beaujolais is sort of a year after vintage, after they've actually had a chance to settle down and age a little bit, can go with almost anything. Côte de Rhône is another great simple wine. We've just had an incredible year, the 1998 vintage in the Southern Rhone Valley was spectacular, and almost anything you buy that says Côte de Rhône 1998 is going to be terrific, and it will probably cost $8-$10.
Now, in the wine column, do you ever feel like you're running out of words because you're describing something similar? You're always writing about wine. Now, granted, there are subtle differences, but it's still wine.
So far, I don't feel I've hit that point. I am concerned that it will come any moment, though, and I think that's when I resign from the wine column. It's still fun. It's still fresh for me. I feel like I'm still finding ways to express my appreciation for wine. I'm still finding new similes for some particular wine experience, and as long as I feel that way, I'll probably keep doing this.
Now, another thing, you're writing about wine all the time. You could be writing, say, about books. If you were writing about new books, you'd be writing often about people who you knew or who you might know or who might be reviewing your books at some point. Is it less complicated to write about wine in that respect?
Yeah, it's much less complicated. It's nice to have another world, I guess. It's also less fierce than the literary world. I was terribly concerned about being an interloper, about how the insiders would feel about my arrival in their world. And in fact, I found the world of wine and food professionals to be extremely welcoming and congenial, something I don't think anyone would say for the for the American literary scene.
So with the holiday season being upon us, what do you plan on drinking for, say, Christmas and New Year's? Do you have that planned?
I'm trying to decide. I'm trying to decide about Christmas dinner. It will either be Burgundy or Pinot Noir. I haven't decided which. But
and why?
As I get older, my taste shifts a little more toward Pinot Noir, which is the grape of Burgundy. It's more food friendly than Cabernet Sauvignon. Cabernet Sauvignon is a little bit more of a club than Pinot, than Burgundy. It's more subtle. It's more aromatic. It's really a food wine, and I'm at the moment divided between an Oregon Pinot Noir and a Gevrey Chambertin. We'll see, and champagne will also be part of the meal. We'll start with a good champagne like Krug. Or Veuve Clicquot, La Grande Dame, or even the old reliable Dom Perignon, which, despite its fame and availability, is actually a truly great champagne.
Well, Jay McInerney, happy eating, drinking, and writing. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Novelist Jay McInerney, his wine columns from House and Garden are collected in his new book, Bacchus and Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Eddie Bauer, supporting radio expeditions and offering outdoor-inspired clothing, accessories, and home furnishings, in stores, catalogs, and at eddiebauer.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, kissing Marlon Brando and climbing Mount Rushmore in heels. We talk with Eva Marie Saint about her roles in On the Waterfront and North by Northwest.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Terry! Terry!
The same way they called Andy the night I lost him. Edie, be careful! Edie, be careful!
That's a scene from On the Waterfront in which Edie, played by Eva Marie Saint, calls after Terry, played by Marlon Brando, as he walks into a trap. Saint's other best-known films are Alfred Hitchcock's comic thriller North by Northwest, John Frankenheimer's family drama All Fall Down, and Exodus about the founding of Israel. On TV, Saint played Sybil Shepherd's mother in the series Moonlighting. Eva Marie Saint stars in a new CBS TV movie this Sunday night called Papa's Angels. Set in Appalachia in the 1930s, the story is about how a family survives after the young wife and mother dies of tuberculosis. When the mother first gets sick, she hides her symptoms from her family. In this scene, her mother-in-law, played by Eva Marie Saint, confronts her with a bloody handkerchief she found while doing the laundry. The young mother, played by Cynthia Nixon, tries to cover up the truth.
Alvin had a bloody nose. Made me mad to ruin a good embroidered handkerchief, but we were in church, so what can you do?
What about this one? How long the bloody nose go on?
Well, you know our children. Somebody's always bleeding. I'm just grateful when bones aren't broken.
Now I know why you and my son get along so good. You're both born liars.
I'm a busy woman. I got more to do than run to a doctor about a bloody nose.
Except it's not a bloody nose, is it? I'm not going to tell you what to do. You won't listen to me any more than Becca will listen to you. But when you go in there, I want you to look at these children and tell me you think my son can raise them without you.
Eva Marie Saint won an Academy Award for her first film, which was On the Waterfront. I asked her how she got the part.
I had been doing many, 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 many live shows on television. And at one point, I did Trip to Bountiful, the Horton Foote play. First it was a television, then he rewrote it as a play with Lillian Gish. And Kazan saw me in that part, Martin Juro, my agent, sent Gazan to see me in that, and he saw it and thought of me as the young virginal blonde and On the Waterfront. And I didn't read for it. I improvised with Marlon Brando, and it was an interesting improvisation because I, to this day, I don't know what he told Marlon, but he did tell me that I was at home and a young man was coming to visit my sister who was not at home, so my job was to keep him out of that house. Don't let him in the door. Well, I don't know what happened, but he went in the door. He came in the living room. We were dancing. We were laughing. I was crying. He was taking my skirt and whoosh, whipping it around, and the sparks flew. And Kazan saw that, and suddenly I was on the waterfront.
Were you used to improvising?
Oh yes, I was from the Actor's Studio. I'd been studying there. I was there about 7 years and all total. And I had seen Marlon there, but I'd never worked with him. I actually worked with Lee Strasberg, and of course Kazan was there too.
Had you seen Brando in anything before starring with him?
Yes, I'd seen his movies, and I'm never in awe of another actor because it's all the same business. Some actors are fine actors, some not quite fine actors, good actors. I'm never in awe of anyone in our profession. I'm in awe of musicians or painters, but I was impressed. and he was adorable, and he was a prince, and he knew it was my first film. It was very cold in Hoboken.
That's where you shot it?
On the waterfront. In Hoboken, on the waterfront right there. And it was very cold. And he was always giving me a jacket to put over my shoulders, and I was skiing at the time, so underneath my virginal navy blue dress, I had red long johns on. So when the morale was low, I threw up my dress and started doing the can-can for all the longshoremen.
That'd be very out of character for your character in the movie.
True, I'm glad. I don't think Kazan saw me because he liked everyone to stay in character. Oh, that's funny. But that got a few laughs. But he was very, very kind, Marlon. We rehearsed constantly, which is what you do on a Kazan film.
Right. Now, in the movie, you have this, like, radiant, pure beauty, but in most of the scenes, you're wearing real schmatas. You're wearing this big drab woolen coat and a kerchief around your head. And
I still have that kerchief.
Do you really?
I always say, I should put it on eBay, right? No, sorry. I usually have one thing from each film, and I have it in a little cellophane bag with a photo of me and Marlon, and there I have the kerchief. I'm holding the kerchief. And actually, it was my kerchief, and you know what it was? It's little squares of Amish carriage, little dark print of a Amish carriage, and it's repeated through the whole little scarf.
You know, often in movies, you know, the beautiful young leading lady is quite glamorous, and you're so unglamorously dressed in this. Did it affect how you felt in the role to be wearing this, like, drab coat and the shmata on your head?
No, when I was making rounds in New York, and the things that I played on live television were not very glamorous. I think you're thinking of North by Northwest. I wasn't really glamorous until mm-hmm. Hitch saw me as a sexy spy lady. And I remember saying to my husband, "My God, he sees me as a sexy spy lady." And my husband said, "Well, so do I." So that made two of them. But no, the only thing is it was navy blue, and for some reason I never, ever wear navy blue. I think I was tired of that dress by the time it was over. Everything was navy. The dress was navy. The coat was navy. And in those days, we did wear those kerchiefs over our head on windy days and cold windy days in New York.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, we wore them. They were very practical, actually. So I didn't feel that I wasn't smartly dressed at all. That navy blue with a little collar, it was a pretty cute dress. I did feel embarrassed in the slip, I must say.
We'll get to that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in this scene from On the Waterfront, you've decided not to see the Brando character anymore. But he's knocking on your door, and you're telling him to stay away. Then you lock the door and chain the door. He breaks into your apartment and finds you in bed wearing this white slip. Let's hear that scene.
Stay away from me.
Come on, please open the door, please.
Stop it. I want you to stay away from me.
I don't know what you want me to do, but I ain't gonna do it, so forget it.
I don't want you to do anything. You let your conscience tell you what to do.
Shut up about that conscience. That's all I've been hearing.
I never mentioned the word before. You just stay away from
me. Edie, you love me. I want you
didn't
to
say... say I didn't love you. I said stay away from me.
I want you to say it to me.
Stay away from me.
And that silence and then the little squeaking is them kissing passionately after she's attempted in vain to fight him off and then gives in. It's really quite a moment in the film. I mean, you look like you're almost about to faint with mm-hmm. being totally overcome by this physical feeling that's very new to you, being in mm-hmm. in his arms. Let's talk about that scene. How is that kiss staged?
How was the kiss staged? Well, we were struggling. And I was hitting his back. And I'm sure it was Kazan who said, just drop that arm at that point. And I
did. To show that you were giving in, that you were kind of succumbing to your feelings.
It. You know, when you just hear it, it's almost like two animals, isn't it? He was very, Marlon, very, very strong in that. And she dropped her conscience, didn't she? He overcame her, and yet she had these strong feelings, and he broke through for both of them. She really did love him. I had trouble actually with that scene because I was in a slip, and in those days I was very modest. And I felt exposed. I'd never been in a slip on screen and on television. And the kiss and all of that, it was pretty physical. And I remember just having trouble when Kazan came up to me and he just whispered the name of my husband. He just said, "Jeffrey." Well, I'm still married to Jeffrey. It's almost 50 years. And, you know, it worked. I mean, that was it. I mean, another director might have struggled with whatever, but he just, one word, and no one heard it. Marlon didn't hear it. No one heard it. And that's how he worked. And somehow I just knew that he knew I would relax if, because he had met my husband, if I thought of Jeffrey. And somehow when he whispered that, I just relaxed and enjoyed it.
There's a scene in this where he's been called downstairs by some of the guys who are out to kill him, and you've chased after him calling his name, and you find him in this narrow alley. And just as you find him and you're running down this alley to meet up with him, a big truck that's as wide as the alley is coming after him and therefore coming after you too. And there's no way you can be in the street without getting hit by this truck. So he breaks into a building and you both rush in, narrowly averting this truck. It's such a beautifully lit scene. You're kind of like in the headlights of the truck, illuminated by it, running for your lives. Were you aware of the lighting when that shot was being made?
You're never aware of the lighting, but it's interesting because when I did see it, it's almost like the hair has a halo.
Yeah.
As I remember. It was a very scary scene because it was wet. I had no idea that truck was going to be as close as it was in the scene. There was a place where we had to get out of the way, and Marlon was supposed to open the door. The door wouldn't open. He actually broke that glass, and he actually cut his hand a little bit. The designated door was not unlocked or was jammed or something. So Marlon Brando is that kind of actor. He broke the glass, and we got inside just in time.
I guess you didn't have to do that scene again.
No. No. Uh-uh.
You won an Oscar for your role in On the Waterfront, and I think 4 days after winning the Oscar, you gave birth to a son.
2 days.
2 days.
Better story, right? 2 days. Yeah.
So those are two big changes in your life happening just about simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, for most people, when they get the Academy Award, they want to be at their most glamorous, and you were at your absolute most pregnant. I'm not sure if you were even able to go to the award ceremony.
Oh, yes. I was sitting there with Jeffrey, and it was in New York. Now it's all in California, but at that time, the New York contingency and the Hollywood contingency, and there was a little jealousy between Hollywood and New York, so we really didn't think there was much of a chance for Waterfront, Black and White, Made in New York. But we went, and we were all there, and some of the people started winning Oscars. And my dear husband said, "Now, honey, if they call your name, I want you to sit here and count to 10 and then go up." Well, I heard my name, and I felt this hand on my thigh, pressing my thigh, and I'm smiling and smiling, and I'm really counting to 10, and then I walked up. I didn't rush up. I walked up and accepted the Oscar and said something like, "I'm so excited, I may have the baby right here." And of course, I had it 2 days. 2 days later.
Eva Marie Saint is my guest, and she's starring in a new movie called Papa's Angels, which will be broadcast Sunday night on CBS. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eva Marie Saint, and she's starring in a new movie called Papa's Angels that will be broadcast on CBS TV this Sunday night. Let's talk about a movie that you made 5 years after On the Waterfront, North by Northwest, which starred you and Cary Grant. And you play the opposite kind of woman in this from what you played in On the Waterfront. In this, you're a very glamorous, beautiful spy working undercover, and it's your job both to seduce Cary Grant and to seduce his nemesis. Why don't we start with a scene from the movie? Cary Grant is on the run. He's been mistakenly accused of being a murderer. He's hiding out on a train. He's seated next to you in the dining car, and he doesn't know that you're a spy, and he doesn't know that you know that he isn't who he pretends to be. So
it's complicated, isn't it?
Here's the scene.
Think how lucky I am to have been seated here.
Well, luck had nothing to do with it.
Fate?
I tipped the steward $5 to seat you here if you should come in.
Is that a proposition?
I never discuss love on an empty stomach.
You've already eaten.
But you haven't.
Don't you think it's time we were introduced?
I'm Eve Kendall. I'm 26 and unmarried. Now you know everything.
Tell me, what do you do besides lure men to their doom on the 20th Century Limited?
I'm an industrial designer.
Jack Phillips, Western sales manager for Kingby Electronics.
No, you're not. You're Roger Thornhill of Madison Avenue, and you're wanted for murder on every front page in America. Don't be so modest.
Oops.
Oh, don't worry. I won't say a word.
How come?
I told you. It's a nice face.
Is that the only reason?
It's going to be a long night.
True.
And I don't particularly like the book I've started.
Ah.
You know what I mean?
Well, let me think. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Eva Marie Saint, how did Hitchcock think of you for this very seductive role when you were best known for playing a woman who is very chaste and plain and, well, chaste and beautiful, but shy, you know, in On the Waterfront?
I don't know. I'm glad that he did. I felt very comfortable playing the role. His set was such that everyone who was on the set, you just had the feeling of such confidence because he saw you and he didn't see anyone else. And right, you can do this. Sure, you're right. You're the sexy spy lady. He didn't give much direction, very different from Kazan. He gave external direction, things like lower your voice, don't use your hands, because I sort of use my hands a lot when I talk, and look directly into Cary Grant's eyes at all times, which was not difficult, but those were the things, and the clothes. He didn't like the clothes that were designed for me, so he took me to New York, and we went to Berghoff Goodman, and he said, anything you want. I used to tease him. I said, you were the only sugar daddy I ever had in my life. I had none before or none after. That afternoon, I felt like I had a sugar daddy. Whatever you want, Eva Marie. And so I took the black dress with the red roses. Remember that? I love that and some other things.
Let's talk about the Mount Rushmore scene where you and Cary Grant are escaping from the people who are out to get you, and you're scaling Mount Rushmore, or what I imagine was a sculpture version, a miniature version of Mount Rushmore. What were you actually climbing on?
We were climbing at, by the way, 2 weeks after I gave birth.
Oh, you're
climbing
kidding.
No. At that time, the doctors didn't want women to gain more than 21 pounds. So once you have your 9-pound baby, there's not much left. But that was at MGM in the studio, and it was very, very high, and it was, you know, it was made of artificial material to make it look like Mount Rushmore, and it was high. I've no listen. An actor who had trouble with heights would have had a difficult time, but I was pretty athletic in high school and college, and so I ski and all that, so I was in good shape, even though I'd had a baby, to climb that darn mountain. And I didn't have any fears. But once we started climbing, and I happened to look down, and I saw that the prop man was putting all these mattresses around the perimeter of Mount Rushmore, and I thought, oh, my God, that's right. We could actually fall, couldn't we? And I remember at one point taking off my heels, as prepared as Hitchcock was, he didn't say, now, even once you get started, you take off those heels. Well, sure enough, I finally took off those heels after I broke a heel on one of the shoes.
Yeah, but you're climbing in your heels for part of it.
I know, for a lot of it, yeah. And Cary Grant was older, and I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it. But someone pointed out at one point I was really ahead of him. I was pulling him, or at least I was ahead.
There's the scene where you've kind of fallen off a ledge of the monument, and you're dangling off the edge of the monument. The only thing you have to hold on to is Cary Grant's hand, mm-hmm. but he's losing his grip, and you're in danger of just falling. What was beneath you at that time, the mattresses?
Yes, and something to I was just, you know, we won't tell everybody, but just a few feet off a box or something. But at one point, I actually did slip further than I was supposed to, because the man who was supposed to catch me was looking the other way. So I slipped about 3 feet more than I should, and I still have a tiny scar on my left elbow. And if you notice in the movie, I actually rub my elbow. And I decided, the actor's studio, it hurts. It really hurts. I don't want to stop filming. I don't want to yell cut. The actor never does that. And I just used it. And there I am in the scene, really rubbing my elbow, which hurt a good deal.
My guest is Eva Marie Saint. She stars in the new TV movie, Papa's Angels. It will be shown Sunday night on CBS. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eva Marie Saint, the star of such films as On the Waterfront, North by Northwest, All Fall Down, and Exodus. You were born in Newark and I think grew up in upstate New York?
I grew up in Albany, New York.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And what did your parents do for a living when you were young?
My mother had been a school teacher in Vineland, New Jersey. She'd been a one-room school teacher. And my dad was with B.F. Goodrich Tire and Rubber Company. So no one in our business, in our family, had ever been in the business. My sister was a research chemist for DuPont. And I was studying to be a teacher and then changed my major in college and went into the theater.
What was your early exposure to acting?
It was in Bowling Green State University, where someone dared me to try out for a play, and I did. And there was just something enlightening about that whole experience, working with other actors. I'd done some practice teaching. I was really going to be a teacher like my mom. But there was something exciting about it. And then I went into did another play. And then one summer, my sophomore year, I wrote to my drama professor and said, I'm thinking of changing from education to liberal arts. And what do you think would be the possibilities for me? And he wrote me a beautiful letter about the possibilities in New York at the time. Live television, radio, the theater was flourishing. And he knew my background, and he said, the main thing is to be able to take rejection. I have a feeling you can. And it was a beautiful letter that I felt was encouraging, because that's what I wanted to do. I might have read it differently if I really wanted to teach. And then I went to my parents and told them, and they said, whatever you want to do, honey, just do your best, which was what they always said to my sister and myself. And they were wonderful about it. I probably wouldn't be talking to you, Terry, if they had said, what are you talking about? Get a job. Get a job with a salary check every week, for God's sake. But they didn't, and so I'll be forever grateful.
Well, you know, you were told that what you needed to do was, you know, be able to take rejection. Were you able to take that?
Yes. And it happened, it's kind of a long story, I'll try to make it short, but when I was in Mr. Roberts, that was the first play I ever tried out for, got the role, the only woman in the whole show. And I actually replaced somebody else who was too tough. I got the role, we were out of town. Josh Logan, the director, came to me after a few performances out of town and said, Eve-Marie, we think we have a hit. We're a little nervous with you because this is your first show, so we would like to keep you as understudy to Jocelyn Brando, who was Marlon's sister. It all gets very incestuous, doesn't it? But I did say, Mr. Logan, I'll take the understudy, and I went down in my dressing room and cried my eyes out, and everybody came in one by one. Eve-Marie, may we come in? And they came in one by one, including Hank Fonda, saying, you know, it's a godsend that you're taking this at such a young age because we've all had rejection. But the fact that you're very young, it'll mean something and nothing will be this worse. So thank, well, it wasn't very comforting to me. But that night on the subway between, I was living with my parents at the time in Jackson Heights, and I was thinking, I'd never want to feel this way again. I never want to be so destroyed. I came from a loving family. No one had ever rejected me in this way. So by the time I get home, I'm going to decide whether I want to stay in this business and or be a teacher. And if I stay in the business, if I make the decision, I'll never, ever allow myself to feel this way again. By the time I got home, I decided I was going to try to continue acting, studying, and whatever happened, wherever I was rejected, when and where, I would never feel this way again. And the feeling this way again meant from my neck down, my heart, my soul, from my neck up, okay, you're disappointed, you're upset from your neck up, but never, never, your soul would never be crushed again, or your heart. And it never has been, I have to say, in all honesty. So those guys were right in Mr. Roberts. So that was a big lesson, big, big, important lesson in my life.
Eve-Marie Saint, she stars in the new TV movie Papa's Angels. It will be shown Sunday night on CBS. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, the story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Chicken Run is now out on video. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creators Nick Park and Peter Lord about their animated satire, The Great Escape with Chickens. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.